Well, in Matthew chapter 5, verse 39, we have a command from Jesus that when looked at literally just doesn't seem to make sense. Well, let's go to Matthew 5, and we'll start out here reading verse 39, and then we'll come back and catch the context of it later on. But here in Matthew 5, verse 39, this is where we'll get the title of this split sermon today, which is Turn the Other Cheek. Turn the other cheek. Well, here in Matthew 5, again, we'll catch this here in the middle. Verse 39, Jesus is talking, and he's saying, "But I tell you not to resist an evil person. But whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also." Well, really? Is Jesus Christ saying that we should continually just turn our cheek and allow it to be slapped over and over again? Well, I like to talk about this expression, turn the other cheek, and hopefully show what I believe Jesus Christ was telling us that instead, what we should instead do. Now, let's first talk about what this verse is literally telling us to do and see that when you boil it down, that the literal interpretation just doesn't seem to make sense. You know, one could actually go to the literal extreme, and a number have, and say that we should let someone continually strike us on our cheeks. And those with the literal interpretation of this verse would likely not just stop at the cheek, but you know, they would say, well, you just allow yourself to be struck over and over. Well, that is one interpretation. But is that what Jesus meant for us here? Well, we could easily go to a few scriptures to show that this literal interpretation is not accurate. If you'd like, you can hold your place in Matthew 5, and let's go to Acts chapter 23. Here in Acts 23, we'll see the example of the Apostle Paul when he was struck in the face. Paul here in Acts 23 was being brought before the religious authorities of the day, and we'll just start here in verse 1, Acts 23, verse 1. Then Paul, looking earnestly at the council, said, "Men and brethren, I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day." And the high priest Ananias commanded those who stood by him to strike him on the mouth. Now notice here that Paul's reaction was not to offer the other cheek to him, but instead, verse 3, Paul said to him, "God will strike you, you whitewashed wall, for you sit to judge me according to the law, and do you command me to be struck contrary to the law?" And so the text here shows that when Paul was struck in the face, he stood there and he verbally defended himself. He didn't literally offer himself so he could be struck again. Now some might say, well, yeah, Paul was human and none of us react perfectly and to every occasion. It certainly wasn't nice to call the high priest a whitewashed wall. But what about Jesus himself? Surely Jesus would live by his own words and turn the other cheek when he was struck. Well, let's turn to John chapter 18. And here we'll find that Jesus had been apprehended here. He was in the last day of his life, and he also has to appear before the religious authorities. But here in John 18, and we'll pick this up in verse 19. John 18, beginning in verse 19, "Then the high priest then asked Jesus about his disciples and his doctrine. And Jesus answered him, 'I spoke openly to the world. I always taught in synagogues and in the temple, where the Jews always meet. And in secret I've said nothing. Why do you ask me? Ask those who have heard me what I said to them. Indeed, they know what I said.' And when he had said these things, one of the officers who stood by struck Jesus with the palm of his hand, saying, 'Do you answer the high priest like that?'" Well, perfect setting, perfect opportunity for Jesus to live by his literal words and turn the other cheek to be struck. But notice instead how Jesus responded. Verse 23, "Jesus answered him, 'If I have spoken evil, bear witness of the evil. But if well, why do you strike me?'" And so not only did Jesus not offer the other cheek, but he responds again verbally to the man who struck him. Not an insult or an evil response, but basically asking the officer, "What'd I do? What did I do? Why did you strike me? Jesus didn't trade insults. And so we can safely conclude that the literal translation of this is not what Jesus meant for us. If we're slapped or we're hit, then if we follow the example of Jesus and Paul, then we'll not just simply stand there quietly and just offer the other cheek to be struck. Let's go back to Matthew 5. Let's read the surrounding verses and see if we can discern what Jesus meant for us here. We know that the context of Matthew chapter 5 is Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. And in this sermon, he started off before these verses that we're going to read. And the context of Matthew 5 is that he was telling us to go beyond the literal, physical aspects of the Old Covenant law. And he added their spiritual meaning and spiritual principles and intents to them. So here in Matthew 5, we'll read here starting in verse 38. You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I tell you not to resist an evil person. But whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also. Jesus had to often explain about fundamental misunderstandings that the Jews had allowed to creep into the law of God. And in many cases, Jesus would take a piece of the law, of the old of God's law, and he says, well, you're applying it the wrong way. And that's what Jesus was doing here. We go on in verse 40. If anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic, let him have your cloak also. Whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Give to him who asks you. From him who wants to borrow from you, do not turn away. And then verse 43, you have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies. Bless those who curse you. Do good to those who hate you. And pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you. The lesson of turning the other cheek that Jesus was trying to teach us involves how we treat people who have wronged us. And that's the main point of this message. Again, the lesson of turning the other cheek that Jesus was trying to teach us involves how we treat people who have wronged us. Jesus' teaching is about diffusing conflicts rather than allowing conflicts to escalate. And so he advocates that we stop the cycle through a willingness to suffer wrong, as we'll go on to see. In the context of this, notice again verse 38 of Matthew 5, which Jesus says, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, which he's referring back to an old covenant law. A very famous saying that, whether you're a so-called Christian, as lots of society would call themselves or not, a lot of people would identify with that saying, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, but would probably interpret it incorrectly. The eye for eye and tooth for tooth phrase is repeated 3 times in the Torah. And if you'd like, you can jot down these 3 places. We'll actually only turn to one of them in this message. But they are in Exodus chapter 21, verses 23 through 25, which we'll turn to in just a minute, Exodus 21, 23 through 25. Deuteronomy chapter 19, verse 21. Deuteronomy 19, 21. And then Leviticus 24, verses 17 through 22. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Again, Leviticus chapter 24, verses 17 through 22. So this wasn't just a phrase that God had thrown out, through Moses, one time. As a passing phrase that he didn't really intend. Instead, it was reemphasized a few times, multiple times, and it was one that he wanted practiced, but with an accurate and a correct understanding. Although the eye for an eye provision of the Mosaic Law has often been misunderstood as requiring vengeance, its actual purpose was to place limitations on vengeance. The punishment must fit the crime. Let's see this in Exodus chapter 21. We'll go back to the first occurrence I mentioned in Exodus chapter 21. Exodus 21, we'll read here beginning in verse 23, where it says, "But if any harm follows, then you shall give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe." Now, I'd like to quote next from the UCG Bible reading program, the online UCG Bible reading on Exodus chapter 21. It says, "The words eye for eye, tooth for tooth were not intended to encourage vengeful feelings, nor were they to be taken literally, you know, although life for life and stripe for stripe could be literal. The principle was that the punishment should fit the crime and not go beyond it. On occasion, capital punishment had to be imposed, but in other cases, we read that there were various ways the guilty party could be redeemed." End quote. And so when judicial decisions were made back in ancient times, you know, the principle that they were given was to use an eye for an eye. It's a principle of compensation, but it was given as a means of putting a lid on vengeance. You know, far from being a savage and a bloodthirsty law, God's setting here a maximum penalty for a range of law-breaking activities, especially those that could cause retaliation, you know, from relatives of those who had been injured. You know, in ancient times, in those times in which the ancient Israelites lived, and even in some societies today, one was often judged very heavily by honor. You know, you defended your honor. You defended the honor of your family, defended the honor of your tribe, you defended the honor of your nation. And, you know, if you recall, about 400 years or so before the Israelites were given this law, their forefathers, two of the sons of Israel, Simeon and Levi, they went and they killed all the males in a village, every last male in this village, because a man in that village named Shechem had gone in to their sister Dinah and defiled her. And if you like, you can read about this later in Genesis chapter 34. Now, we know the act that Shechem did was a sin. God would call it a sin. But you know, when this story is read, what we see is that Shechem was eventually willing to do the right thing after the initial sin. He wanted to marry Dinah and was even willing to go so far as to have not just himself, but all of the males in the village where he lived in circumcised. The reason being is that, you know, it was the custom of the of Jacob and his sons, of them at that time, to be circumcised. And they felt like that, because they were told that, hey, if you were circumcised, then that would give honor, and that would satisfy honor. However, Simeon and Levi were not interested in showing godly mercy. They were driven by avenging the honor that they felt like had been taken away, away from their family. And so again, they went in and they killed every male in the village, which of course was not proportional to the original crime that had happened. And it was these types of actions that the eye for eye and tooth for tooth principle that God later would bring out, those types of actions that principle was supposed to curtail. Another important context of this law is that it was focused on judges to ensure that, you know, the judges handed out a penalty that was proportional to the crime or to the sin. You know, many of the ancient cultures, you know, they had laws that gave very disproportionate punishments for crimes, particularly for poor people or people who were of lesser status. It was very common, for instance, if you were to steal bread, In some cultures, if you still stole bread, then they would come and chop off the hand of the person who did that. And of course, then the person who stole the bread was in a far worse situation, because then he only had one hand, and it was very difficult then for him to be able to, you know, provide and to work. You know, this was also a common problem, you know, throughout history, in the time of Jesus Christ as well, that if someone poor or someone was weaker than you or was in a lower station in life, if he injured somebody powerful, even if it was accidental, then oftentimes the penalty was, you know, a lifelong banishment, punishment, maybe even death. You know, as I was reading this and writing this, it reminded me of the movie Ben-Hur. I'm sure some of you probably have seen that movie. In that movie, the main character, Ben-Hur, was played by Charlton Heston, and he and a female friend were up on the roof of a place, and down below, the Roman army was crossing in the street, was passing by, and the woman that was up there accidentally dislodged a heavy stone, and it fell down, and it frightened the horse of the Roman general, throwing the general off of his horse. Well, obviously, he was not very happy, and went to find the perpetrator of the crime, and, you know, the main character, again, Ben-Hur, he went ahead and took the blame for it, even though it was the female that had pushed the stone down, and his punishment was a lifetime of slavery, and not very pleasant. And that was just the way it was back in those times. You know, if you struck an officer, an overseer, or someone in charge, oftentimes a penalty would be death, immediate death. And so there was these disproportionate punishments that judges would hand out, like I said, in particular for poor people or people of lesser status. And so in this context, then the eye for an eye and the tooth for the tooth law that God gave was there to maximize the punishment that was given out. It was actually there to minimize it, to make sure it was proportional to the actual crime. And so coming back to Matthew chapter 5 now, Christ is teaching on this law of retaliation, because the Jews at that time of Christ were still very much living in that society driven by honor. And so, you know, Christ then he quoted the law, and then he had to explain what the purpose of that was. You know, it's interesting, because when you look at the Gospels and you look at different interactions in the Gospels, you see that, you know, in that society, you know, people did oftentimes try to, you know, maximize or get the most out of what they could. You remember the two apostles called the sons of thunder. You know, they wanted to call lightning down from heaven for the people of the city that had didn't treat Jesus the way that they felt he should be treated. You know, it was a mindset that was pervasive in the culture of the time. Instead of minimizing the amount of vengeance, the carnal human reaction is to try to get every bit of vengeance out of it. And if you go back to Matthew 5:39, you know, verse 39 here begins by saying, "Do not resist evil." You know, the word "resist" is from the Greek word anthistemi, and elsewhere in the New Testament, the word refers to standing up in opposition to, arguing with, or disputing with. You know, it's the way it's worded in other verses. So in context, the verse begins by advising us not to engage in disputes or quarrels with people, even though they may be in the wrong. Now again, this doesn't mean that we just stand around waiting for somebody to treat us badly. You know, in other places, the New Testament clearly tells us to stand firm with resolve against evil. You know, very quickly, I'll just give you a couple of scriptures. James chapter 4, verse 7. James 4, verse 7 tells us to submit yourselves, therefore, to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Ephesians chapter 6, verse 13. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand. So we don't just stand there and let ourselves just have evil done to us. But Jesus was making the point that going on and entering into conflicts with evil people is advised against. It's not what is intended. And so just like in the rest of his Sermon on the Mount, Jesus went much further than the Mosaic law. He wasn't merely calling for limitations on vengeance, you know, like the eye for eye and tooth for tooth law does, but Jesus implied that we must give up personal vengeance altogether. You know, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. You know, in 1 Peter, it says that when Jesus was reviled, he did not revile in return. Instead, we are to still treat in a loving way those who have wronged us in life. You know, Matthew, again, verse 43 through 44, Matthew 5, which we read earlier, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, and pray for those who spitefully use you. And so Jesus' teaching is, don't trade insults with your adversary, even if it means opening yourself up to more of their insults. Jesus is teaching us about diffusing conflict rather than allowing conflicts to escalate. And he advocates that one way to stop the cycle is through a willingness to just take it, to suffer wrong. And unfortunately, that there are many examples, you know, over the years that I can think of people who have not done this, who have, if they would have been willing to just step back and take the supposed abuse and to suffer an injustice, that perhaps the conflicts would not have escalated, and perhaps they wouldn't have escalated. Perhaps people wouldn't have suffered as a result of that. Some things I think about specifically. But, you know, our society, society teaches us, well, we can't just let insults slide. You know, we have to respond. We have to respond to those who wrong us. And this is exactly what Christ is saying we can't do. As Christians, we oftentimes have to just let it slide, let it go, not responding to evil with evil. In Proverbs 20, verse 22, it says, do not say, I will recompense evil. Wait for the Lord, and he will save you. And loving someone who has hurt you can often be very difficult, I know. You know, it goes against our carnal nature to do that. It's very difficult sometimes to obey the command to honor your father and your mother when they've wronged you. However, if someday, sometime, an opportunity to do good to that someone comes up, then if it doesn't put us in a dangerous situation, then God expects us to do so. Again, we aren't to put ourselves purposely into dangerous situations. We don't continually put ourselves into abusive situations. I want to emphasize that. But it is true that loving other people will often make you more vulnerable to being hurt. But a true Christian is so dedicated to loving others that they're willing to run the risk of being hurt again. Now think about the Beatitudes earlier in the chapter, earlier in Matthew 5. You know, God still wants us to be merciful. He still wants us to be peacemakers. And he says, bless those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Wonderful blessing. Wonderful blessings in store for those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. And we will be blessed by how we choose to bless others, especially our enemies. And we see in the eye for eye and tooth for tooth command that the intent always has been for love and for mercy and for true justice. That was always the intent. And how merciful and how loving we are towards others largely determines how merciful God will be when he judges us, when he deals with us. Let's turn to 1 Peter. In 1 Peter chapters 2, 3, and 4, they have an overall theme that just as Jesus Christ suffered for doing good, sometimes we too will suffer for doing good according to the will of God. We'll read just a few of these scriptures here. 1 Peter chapter 2 will begin in verse 18. 1 Peter 2 verse 18, "Servants, be submissive to your masters with all fear, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the harsh. For this is commendable if, because of conscience towards God, one endures grief, suffering wrongfully. For what credit is it if, when you are beaten for your faults, you take it patiently? But when you do good and suffer, if you take it patiently, then this is commendable before God. For to this you were called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow in his steps, who committed no sin, nor was deceit found in his mouth, who, when he was reviled, did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but committed himself to him who judges righteously." You and I, in this season of the year in which we are to be examining ourselves and looking for our sins and things that we need to grow in, one thing we can do is we can be asking ourselves, am I doing all that I can to be a peaceful person? Do we look for opportunities to smooth ruffled feathers? Or are we instead those proud people who constantly have to let others know, I was right, they were wrong? Do we take seriously Christ's instruction for us to turn the other cheek? Or do we feel that fear that others will just label us as pushovers? Chapter 3 of 1 Peter, 1 Peter 3, verse 8, "Finally, all of you be of one mind, having compassion for one another. Love as brothers, be tenderhearted, be courteous, not returning evil for evil, or reviling for reviling, but on the contrary, returning a blessing, knowing that you were called to this, that you may inherit a blessing." Again, how we choose to treat others, including those who have done evil to us, again, as verse 9 says, it's a part of our calling. It's what we've been called for. And by practicing these things and being a blessing to everyone, then we set ourselves up to one day inherit far greater blessings from God. Verse 16, 1 Peter 3, "Having a good conscience, that when they defame you as evildoers, those who revile your good conduct in Christ may be ashamed. For it is better, if it is the will of God, to suffer for doing good than for doing evil. For Christ also suffered once for sins, the just for the unjust, that he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, but being made alive by the Spirit." So again, Jesus Christ, the older brother, set the model in this for us, being willing to suffer unjustly. Going on in chapter 4, 1 Peter 4, verse 12. 1 Peter 4, 12, "Beloved, don't think it strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing had happened to you. But rejoice to the extent that you partake of Christ's sufferings, that when his glory is revealed, you may also be glad with exceeding joy. If you are reproached for the name of Christ, blessed are you, for the Spirit of glory and of God rests upon you. On their part, he's blasphemed, but on your part, he is glorified. But let none of you suffer as a murderer, a thief, or an evildoer, as a busybody in other people's matters. Yet, if anyone suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God in this matter." So there is a difference between suffering as a Christian, one who perhaps didn't deserve the suffering. There's a difference between that and one who suffers the consequences of their bad actions. Scripture tells us that over and over. We all reap what we sow. And it doesn't always happen immediately. And sometimes the reaping comes later on. You might be within your legal, quote-unquote, legal rights to retaliate in like manner to insults or other personal affronts, but a willingness to suffer wrong is often the only way that reconciliation can be achieved. You know, going above and beyond the minimal legal requirements, you know, it could bring about reconciliation. It could bring friends to those who were once our enemies. The entire section of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapters 5, 6, and 7 can be understood as one where Jesus actually serves to elevate the importance of following the moral law beyond the letter to the spirit of the law. You know, again, in chapter 5, it starts out with the Beatitudes, showing that there are blessings for how we react to life's situations. It goes on to tell us to let your light so shine before men. And, you know, it goes on, says that we're to obey the letter of the law, not only by not murdering someone, but by not being angry with someone without cause. Not only are we not to commit adultery, we're not to lust after a woman. Now, nor do we not swear at all, but let your yes be yes and your no be no. And then we turn the other cheek for someone who abuses us, and to love and to pray for our enemies instead of getting revenge on them. You know, it all fits together. It all flows together. The message that Jesus was giving us in this Sermon on the Mount is consistent throughout, that we are to go beyond the letter to the spirit of the law. But you know, even in the giving of the letter of the law in the Old Testament, we see glimpses of the spirit of the law mixed in. Let's turn back to Leviticus chapter 19. This will be our final scripture in this message, Leviticus 19. Even in the Old Testament, we see where we are to take the high ground and practice showing love to those who hurt us. Leviticus 19, we'll read verse 18. Leviticus 19, verse 18, "You shall not take vengeance, nor bear any grudge against the children of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord." So even though the law spells out the penalty for someone who does you harm, who hurts you, it still says that we're not to go above that and escalate that and take vengeance, and that we are to love our neighbor still. And so as we've illustrated today by the examples of Jesus and Paul and Peter, there is a difference between confronting evil and seeking personal revenge. It is possible to confront evil with the desire for the restoration of the sinner. You know, we are called to love the sinner while confronting his sin. But when we seek vengeance, then we get to that point, then our motivation becomes one of hatred, and we play into Satan's hands. So in the context of turning the other cheek, you know, there is a middle ground. Middle ground which admittedly can sometimes be hard to find. We are not to let someone slap us over and over and over. Turning the other cheek in this way would become an encouragement for evil, with people continuing to take advantage of you. Jesus and Paul's examples show that they did not turn the other cheek in this literal way. But we're not to jump into the other ditch and demand more than an eye for an eye or a tooth for a tooth. We're not to exact vengeance on others. That's God's job to do. By asking them to turn the other cheek, Jesus meant for his disciples to be motivated by love and a desire for the redemption and forgiveness of the offender, and a desire for reconciliation, while still opposing their actions. So once again, the lesson of turning the other cheek, Jesus was trying to teach us, involves how we have treated people who have wronged us. So how might we apply Jesus' words? Well, if someone insults you, next time someone insults you, maybe on some minor everyday issue, then you have a choice. You can make a really big deal out of it to the point of even exacting vengeance, or you might consider loving them, doing good to those who hate you, blessing those who curse you, and praying for those who spitefully use you. In other words, turn the other cheek.